That's Bobby Bear. He's a football fan, and he's obviously very devout. Phil Conlon is smiling. You're going to say something. You're going to.
I always loved watching the dropkick, but it kind of faded, right?
You know who could do it? Is Flutie. Yeah. In a game for the New England Patriots when he's backing up Brady, which meant he didn't have any work, they scored a touchdown, and they said, you know who can do this is Doug Flutie. And Flutie, a former CFL star, went out there and dropkicked an extra point, which is very hard to do. And speaking of somebody that probably appreciates this matter... Is Norman Otis Richmond? Are you there? This is the bluesologist, Norman Otis Richmond.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Not bad. We have to say there's a special point here. You know, football and politics, and we just noticed religion, of course, war, all related. For Black Americans, Canadian Football League and the Grey Cup, all these things have a little more resonance because. While today the leading NFL quarterbacks are the four top-rated are Black, there was a time there was no such thing as a Black quarterback in the NFL, and those who were determined to play that position, when told they couldn't do it in the U.S., they came to Canada. Am I right?
Yes, you are right, including John Henry Jackson, who used to own the Underground, one of the owners of the Underground Railroad. He came.
That's a restaurant.
He played with the Toronto Argonauts. He may have played with someone else before that, but he was an Argonaut, and also Dave Mann. I don't remember.
Oh man, there was a good football player.
He was also an owner of the Underground Railroad, and he, according to him, he was Huey Newton's cousin. Yeah, he was Huey P. Newton's first cousin. Right.
That is, it's so often, by the way, that we get a lot of connections between well-known political figures in Black politics in America, and they do have, many of them have sports connections and related to some of the best-known players. And because the NFL and all these people are so touchy about these things, they tend not to mention. But
well, Dave Mann mentioned it. It's not funny, but when Huey was assassinated, there was a big meeting. And Dave Mann announced that, you know, after Huey had joined the Ancestors. So you're right, absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you remember the name Johnny Bright? He played at Drake, and he was one of the first Black star running backs in college football. And there was a horrible moment. Life magazine caught it. It was a picture. And he was standing still watching the play, and a Oklahoma, all-white Oklahoma team, no longer, by the way, but in those days, during segregation, raced at him and hit him and broke his jaw, is my memory. And, of course, there was no place for him in the NFL. He was knocked out of college that year because of the injury, but he came up here and was a star.
No, but I do remember Doug Williams' brother, Michael Williams came. Doug Williams, of course, was the first Black, first Black quarterback to win a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. They went to Gremlin University, and I remember Michael Williams coming to Toronto. I saw him, and he was complaining because he was 5'11", and mm-hmm. they thought he was too short to play in the NFL.
Another category of athlete who did come to Canada to prove they could do it. Doug Flutie, we mentioned a while ago, everybody told him he was too short. He kept throwing touchdown passes, kept running when he needed to, but, you know, he didn't look right. He's somehow too small.
Well, Michael didn't. I don't know what happened to Michael and the Argonauts, but he did go to Saskatchewan or someone, and he did play in the CFL. That's Michael Williams, the younger brother of Doug Williams.
Mm-hmm. The greatest Black quarterback who came to Canada, he proved himself here and in a way that they couldn't ignore him. Sort of like at the moment they're trying to ignore Kaepernick. They obviously are kind of hungry to have him, but on the other hand, there's this problem. Well, of course, Warren Moon's problem, he was a Black quarterback. But with the Edmonton Eskimos, he was a marvelous player.
Yeah, Warren Moon came from Manual Arts High School in Los Angeles, right? He was And he was number one in the PFL and the NFL, right?
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Grambling. You've actually been on the campus. You've actually seen this place. This was a very important academic institution, but it produced many, many marvelous football players and, well, athletes all generally.
Well, Grambling is it's an all-black college town, and I was born in a place called Arcadia, which is near Grambling, but my uncle Milton Kelly was the sheriff, and I remember he took me to the jail, and I think they had one.
What did you do? I'm sorry.
No, he was the sheriff, and I think they had like one. It wasn't even a cell; it was like a room that had a bed in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that particular time, I think the most problem that they might have had is somebody got arrested for smoking some marijuana, which was kind of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And Grambling was a dry county, so they had to go to Ruston, Louisiana, which was, you know, it's like going to Mississauga from Toronto, mm-hmm. or going to Scarborough, get your liquor and bring it back, you know. But Grambling is an all-black town, but it was a college town, and it many of the first black professional football players came out of Tank Younger. I think he was born and raised in Grambling. I think he might have been one of the first. It was Los Angeles Ram, I thought. And I think I remember hearing Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, who was the big man in the Black Panther Party. He said he wanted to go to Grambling to play football, but his people made him go to Los Angeles and join the Black Panther Party. Yeah, he wanted to be a football player, because I mean Grambling is legendary for producing football.
Yeah, you know, I think they've done research. You know, they used to say, well, what universities produce the most NFL players? And I think Grambling was always in the top two or three. It may have been the top. And people said, that's where it led. You know, most Americans didn't even know Grambling existed, because this whole thing of segregation and there were a series of schools that were black schools that produced wonderful athletes, and people always scratch their heads, well, where is that place?
Well, I remember Grambling. I went to school with a young man by the name of Richard Stebbins, and mm-hmm. Stebbins won in 64 Olympics. He won a gold medal. He was the third man on the relay. He passed the baton to Bob Hayes, and he ran in the – he made the finals in the 200 meters, but yeah, he went to Grambling. And I remember one time we went to Los Angeles Coliseum, and Grambling came up to the relays. And I remember Richard won the 100 meters, 200, and anchored the relay. Grambling won everything, right?
You saw Grambling at the Coliseum.
Yep. Richard Stebbins and I think it was Vernus Ragsdale. I think he was from San Diego. And the other two, I can't remember the other two gentlemen, but they were all Los Angeles people. And that was a Coliseum packed in terms of, because, you know, Richard was, Stebbins was, he had won the city championships and all of that. So the place was basically packed to see him.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond, bluesologist. And another name that we should remember, and you reminded me of him earlier today, because he made it big in the movies, who played here, is friend of Jackie Robinson, teammate. His name was Woody Strode.
Yeah, Woody Strode went to a school called Jefferson High School. And Jefferson High School, and at one time in Los Angeles, black people could only go to two high schools. That was Thomas Jefferson High School and Jordan High School. People that went to Jefferson High School were people like Dorothy Dandridge, Ralph Bunch, and Roy Ayers, and mm-hmm. Johnny Guitar Watson, and mm-hmm. People like that. And then Jordan High School produced Flo Jo and what's his name, Charles Mingus and Brenda Holloway.
Did you say Charles Mingus?
Mingus, right. Charles Mingus. The jazz musician, right.
So they could, same alma mater as Woody Strode.
No, Woody Strode went to Jefferson High School.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were still talking about Jefferson. I lost track.
So Jefferson would be the same alma mater as Roy Ayers. Yeah, Roy Ayers is Roy Ayers, of course, is the man who performed with Fela in Nigeria. Yeah, Africa, center of the world. That's Roy Ayers and Fela. They were like key spars, or they were very, very close.
For people who may not know, if there was a great, one of the great westerns ever made, it was called Once Upon a Time in the West, and Woody Strode has the first, I'd say 10 minutes of that film, he stands out in, it's a great opening for a movie, and it's, if you got, people have to see this, Woody Strode is the black cowboy who's about to meet the gunfighter. It's a very tremendous scene, and he was, it is remarkable. He was Jackie Robinson's teammate at UCLA in the backfield. And that was a time of segregation, but because of the arrival of many, many black Americans leaving the segregation south, they came from Texas, they came from Louisiana, like Norman, and from, but and they became a big force in California. And I think those people like Jackie, people talking about Jackie Robinson in baseball, he helped also through football, because football brought 100,000 people into the stadium, and UCLA was a winning team because of Jackie Robinson and Woody Strode and a name I can't come up with, but you may know, the great running back.
Was it Kenny Washington?
Kenny Washington, yes. But if my father were part of this discussion, he'd be kicking me for this, because he thought Kenny Washington was the best of the group. He appreciated Jackie Robinson, but he said Kenny Washington was the one. There are statues of him, by the way, in Los Angeles, I'll have you know. Now, one last point I want to make sure we cover, Norman, because some people think this course is, well, they understand that there are racial issues still in football. But even today, we've heard accounts that this great young quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens, who is tearing up the league right now, when he first came to the team, they said that some coaches were talking to him, thinking maybe he should be a wide receiver. And I mean, that really, that's the old signal, right?
Well, apparently the African, especially those ones that were taken to America, the American Negro, according to the narrative, is that the American Negro is probably the dumbest human being that ever lived in the world, because you can't make it in America. There's nothing wrong with America. There's something wrong with you. Mm. So, you know, Jesse Jackson was a quarterback. Allen Iverson was a quarterback.
Was he?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, because the quarterback is supposed to be the brain.
Exactly.
And the, you know, the black American being the dumbest human being on the planet Earth.
Of course, we're talking about the mind of the segregationists, yes.
I'm saying that the imperialists actually put that out. That was the narrative to justify imperialism. You know.
Oh, well, sure. We lived all through those struggles of the 60s. We were always getting out of academia these pseudo-scientific studies saying, oh, no, they can't do this. They don't do math or some crazy thing. And and why are they saying it? Because, of course, they know that if you break through that threshold, which has happened, the idea that you have to have a white owner, a white coach, and a white quarterback, that whole system is going to collapse, and a bunch of people are going to lose their jobs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I wanted to say something about, like, Gerald Horn used to always point out that, you know, that the external situation is basically, it was that whole question of racism. In order for the United States to, they had to basically give Africans in America a break, because the Soviet Union and the socialist camp,
yes,
China, and you know, mm-hmm. Yugoslavia, they put so much pressure on the United States. They had, that's how a lot of things open up for black people in America, because of the external contradictions in the world.
Yeah, Martin Luther King said, and at that time it was really, really true, the world is watching.
Yep, exactly.
And that did it, made him sweat. They didn't want to pass the Genocide Convention because they knew that they were liable to a pretty clear charge.
We charged genocide. I have the book by, it was a book put together
Paul Robeson.
By Paul Robeson and William Patterson. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, I can't remember, 49 maybe. I'm losing, having the... an adult senior moment. Mm-hmm. I think it was 1949, but yeah, I think Patterson might have been in Paris, and I think Robeson was in New York, or vice versa, but they basically, you know, held joint press conferences, and that really put the United States put them in big trouble.
Yeah. You know, no, I'm really glad you remind us. Taylor Report, we're going to take this under advisement. I think we should go and get that document. They went to a lot of trouble to prepare it. We should.
You're talking about that.
We should put it back on the agenda. So let's have a look. See how this argument holds up.
I bought a copy of that book in the communist bookstore in Detroit. I never will forget it. It was like the owner of the store. He had to be in his 90s. It was he and his wife. And I went in there and picked that book up, I don't know, for maybe $2 or something like that. And it's one, I don't, it's in a box around my place someplace. I have to find that book.
We'll send a group over to help you find it.
Yeah, we definitely have to, we should dust that one off and talk about that.
No, I think we have to. I mean, that's people say, why did Robeson get in trouble? Why did they take his passport away? Why did they not let him travel? Well, because he was an intellectual and a great athlete, and he had the name and the title that commanded respect. They wanted to take that away from him because he drew up a solid indictment of the history of oppression. So.
And you know,
we owe it to Paul Robeson to bring that back into public attention.
He had women, and women were involved in that. Like Carlotta Bass was a black publisher out of Los Angeles, California. I forgot the name of her newspaper, but she had a great left wing newspaper. Claudia Jones out of Trinidad and Tobago, who was deported and had to go to England.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty tough.
She was part of that document, and it was men, women, people from the Caribbean as well as North America that were part of that situation. Mm-hmm. I think that Danny Brathwaite, who was he's Bajan background, but he was born in Nova Scotia. His son Paul Brathwaite is a lawyer, mm-hmm. and Danny Brathwaite. They supported that particular document at that particular time. They had because Danny Brathwaite was a dual man. He was a Garveyite and a Paul Robeson man at the same time.
I'm glad he did it.
They actually sent a message from Toronto to the Bandung Conference in 1954-55. I have another senior moment. I guess it was Bandung Conference in 55. Yes, 55, yeah. Right.
Well, I'm really glad you called the attention to all these matters, Norman. You've given us some work to do, so we really appreciate talking to you, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Doug. Bye-bye. That's Norman Otis Richmond.